Welcome to my podcast, My Secret Life with an Eating Disorder. My name is Maureen Kritzer-Lang. Today's podcast is a rebroadcast of my interview with Hera Allison on her amazing podcast, Beneath Your Beautiful. I really loved our discussion and thought to rebroadcast. Enjoy it and thank you for listening.
Welcome to Beneath Your Beautiful, where guests share stories of adversity and perseverance, which inspire, encourage, and challenge us. We embrace these tough conversations, intimately exploring our loves, fears, and hopes with a delicious combination of depth and lightness.
Hi, I'm Maureen Kritzer-Lang, the queen of self-esteem. I have been a psychoanalyst for about 25 years in private practice, working with women who have eating disorders, body image issues, trauma, anxiety, depression, all ages. I don't see many men in my practice, so my focus is primarily with women. I had an eating disorder for many, many years that I developed when I was probably about 15 years old.
What do you think inspires an eating disorder?
It's interesting to use the word inspires an eating disorder.
I'm asking because for myself, I don't know why I do it or have done it. That inspired the question. How does one start on this journey? Where does it come from?
It comes from many sources. I think in my case, I was about between 13 and 15 years old. And I came from a very privileged family. I'm from Dayton, Ohio. And my father was an obstetrician gynecologist. And I'm the oldest of four. And from all intents and purposes, it looked like the perfect Midwestern family. My mother was beautiful, the perfect doctor's wife. And when I was 10, my family built a custom-built house and we moved on up and moved to a more of a suburban area. And I just remember really being unhappy. And it's funny, as a child, I was very creative. I loved dressing up. I still love to dress up. I loved fashion. I loved creating stories. I loved writing stories. I was in dance, theater. I played the flute. So I did so many things. And then I felt like at some point my world shifted. I think a couple of reasons. One is my parents started having more marital issues. I think the stress of having four kids, just my dad's practice was getting larger and developing. And I was at a new school and not sure how to fit in. And I was really uncomfortable. A lot of the kids had been going to school together for many years. I was a new person. And I just felt like I had trouble talking. And I was always pretty social. So I always sort of looked okay.
Yeah.
But I just never quite felt quite right. And at some point, I decided it was because I was too fat. And I just didn't like my body. So it was really as a way of, I thought I could be happier, prettier, more social, all those things. And the other thing, and I see this with a lot of people too, is my body started changing. So I noticed like stretch marks around like my hips. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever said, oh, your body changes as you develop.
Right.
And it's not that you're getting fat. It's that your body is changing. And I hated it. So the interesting thing is that I asked my mom if she could take me to this like local Weight Watchers. It wasn't Weight Watchers there, but it was like kind of like that. And I was the youngest person there. And I went and they taught me like exchanges and, you know, how to diet. And I literally did it perfectly and ended up losing a lot of weight. And I wasn't really ever big to begin with. I was sort of average size. I didn't really know how to stop dieting. And also it became then sort of my new obsession. And I would make all kinds of weird things. And I became very adamant about how my mother cooked things and, you know, counting calories. And the thing is that nobody noticed really. I mean, I lost weight. And in our culture, even back then, I got so many compliments and I felt really good about getting the compliments, but I didn't feel better on the inside at all.
And then I was just being tortured and starving.
Yeah. I lost my period,
a typical anorexic symptom.
And my dad was an obstetrician gynecologist. And there was no warning sign like, oh, I could have a problem here.
Was there a lot of information or some information back then about anorexia?
There actually wasn't. It was around the time that Karen Carpenter died.
Okay.
So even with Karen Carpenter, I don't really remember if people said she was anorexic. I don't know if it was a heart attack or something relating to her heart gave out. And the issue is when people do die, because people do die from anorexia, that it usually doesn't say from anorexia. It usually says from, you know, a heart attack or, you know, some other kind of medical complication.
I see.
I remember going to bookstores way before technology, like so many years ago. And I couldn't even find books on it. I found a book, Cherry Boone, who was Pat Boone's daughter. I think her book was called Starving for Attention. And there was a book about a dancer who had an eating disorder. But I didn't really even know I had an eating disorder. I didn't even really identify that I had an eating disorder, because if I had one, then I would have to get help. And I really didn't want to get help because I was afraid getting help would mean that somebody would take it away from me and that I would gain weight. But I did such crazy things. Like, I remember eating oatmeal in the morning and eating it with a baby spoon because I was starving and it would take longer to eat. Mm-hmm. My mom and I had a lot of conflicts about food when I'd really never had issues with food previously. And I think it was also because growing up was so hard. So one of the stages that people do develop an eating disorder is at this adolescent age, because they can look very adult-like. And again, because I was the oldest, my mom was pretty overwhelmed. She was 20 when she had me. So she had four kids by the time she was 30. And so I feel like I was sort of like her friend, and we would go shopping together. I would go with her to get her hair done. And so I was sort of this little mini adult, but really I wasn't equipped to be an adult. And I didn't really feel like I was smart enough in school. I was having trouble, even though I still got good grades. So people didn't really know what was going on inside of me. And I think that anorexia developed as a way of staying little. You stay invisible. You stay like a body of a little girl instead of a woman, because you're not really ready to take that next step. As I lost weight and as I went through high school, I was really pretty thin. And then I was going to college, and I also went to an arts camp called Interlochen in Northern Michigan. And I was in their dance program. I was in their theater program. And I literally have books with calorie counts. I think it was this way of trying to regulate my emotions, you know, looking back with the calorie counting. And it kept me from thinking about everything else that felt really hard. I actually wanted to get out of Ohio. And I had met people at this camp from the East Coast. And I felt like that's where I wanted to go to college, was in New York. I was trying to kind of plan my life, but still feeling very unsure. And one of the things that I did is I started writing, because I wanted to also be a journalist. Like, I wanted to be so many things. So I thought, if I'm going to be a journalist, I have to learn to write. I had to discipline myself to write. So I wrote every day. And I would write about how much I hated myself, you know, stay on my diet, how much I hated my body, needed to do my schoolwork. I had this list of like things that I needed to do all the time to stay really busy. I was depressed, and then went away to college. I went to Syracuse. So I got to go out east, and I was so overwhelmed there, like such a fish out of water. The first day I was at my dorm, I expected people to have like name tags and like be very like friendly, right? And somebody came up to me and she said, "Honey, you're not in Kansas anymore." And so I adjusted, but my eating disorder got worse. And I became more and more rigid about what I was eating. It really was living in this prison. And I didn't even know to get help. And so what happened is, I think my sophomore year, I joined a sorority. I moved into a sorority house. And I remember my parents telling me that they're splitting up. There were a lot of family issues that were happening. And I think it was my way of coping. because I couldn't really say like, I'm so depressed, like I am not doing well because my parents had so much going on and I tried to look so perfect all the time. And then I went home for the summer. My mother, I remember so distinctly this moment where my mom was talking to my dad and they would go back and forth. And, you know, my dad moved in, he moved out. And there was another woman who was involved in the picture. And I remember my mom making plans with my dad to go to dinner. And I was so angry with her. And that night, I remember binging. And I never read this anywhere. I never saw this anywhere. I never like got the idea from anything. But I felt so full and disgusting that I decided I was going to stick my finger down my throat and throw up to get rid of the food. And that then set me on this trajectory of developing bulimia. It was a secret. I was ashamed. I felt guilty. You know, I'd swear to myself I would stop. I would write. I would keep journals about it, always looking for help. But people didn't really know that much about eating disorders. After college, my eating disorder just blew up. I got really depressed. I started getting very nervous to go places. One of the warning signs also with an eating disorder is your world gets smaller. So literally, I didn't go out. I stopped talking to people. And I remember saying to my dad, I feel like something's really wrong. Like, I'm not doing well. You know, this is how I remember it, my perspective of it. He said to me, you know, I've gotten you this far. You're attractive. You're smart. You've done so many things. Like, basically, like get it together. I remember thinking that somebody was going to find me dead on the bathroom floor. I went to a support group and I don't remember much about it. I remember just learning how to have a better eating disorder.
What did that mean?
Learning about laxatives. I remember learning about Epicac syrup. I remember about like different foods that are better to throw up. It was a kind of a how to have a better eating disorder.
That wasn't the point, but that's what you got from it.
I don't remember much about it. I just remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And so at one point I got very scared. And I found a psychiatrist and she said to me, you're sitting there looking perfect with a smile on your face and telling me horrible things. And I think it's not safe for you to be here by yourself. And I feel like I need to call your parents. You need to go into a hospital. I feel like you are in danger. And thank God for her. I don't even know her name, anything. We went to Yom Kippur services as a family, this whole like picture of perfect. And we went to services. And after services, my parents took me to the hospital. And it was a hospital in Cincinnati because too many people knew us in Dayton. And I went to a regular hospital, but I went to a psych floor. Not for eating disorders, there was no eating disorder programs, eating disorder treatment, no nutritionist. And I spent 6 weeks in the hospital. It was this balance of being afraid of giving it up or getting help and wanting it so badly. There was an article in Glamour magazine about eating disorders. This is the early 80s, and people were starting to find out more about it. And there was an article in Glamour magazine that talked about this center in New York. A woman named Ellen Shore ran this clinic, and I called it. And she saved my life. When I look back, I think there was nothing magical that she said to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really safe place. You know, we talked about my feelings. At one point, with my symptoms decreasing, she said to me, now we can really start to do therapy. Because so much of my therapy was about managing my symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And really not the feelings that were causing the symptoms to begin with.
I have had weight issues my whole life, and I have not gone to functions because I felt fat. I have had body issues. Really, truly breaks my heart that so many people suffer in their body. I'm not saying it like it happens to other people. I totally get it, and I feel so sad about it, though. So how do you now help people who are suffering in this way?
Good question. Part of it is really sitting with them, like Ellen, my therapist, sat with me. But also, there's so many other things now that we have, you know, whether it's a nutritionist, better medication, support groups. But for me, I really try to help someone understand the feelings behind it. I think what's so sad is it's so hard for, and I'll say women because that's who I mostly work with, and teenagers, to really believe in themselves and feel good about themselves. And they are such amazing people. It's this critical, critical voice. So what I try to do is help them question that and talk about like the eating disorder thought versus like a normal thought. Is that like realistic? Like cognitively challenge it, but really questioning like, why are you so mean to yourself? Everybody's journey is so different and different story, different version of it. But I had books and books of like how much I hated myself. Trusting your body is so hard. Like trusting your body to eat is really hard.
People who eat normally don't see that. And so tell me what you mean by that.
To trust your body, meaning that you can eat something and you'll be okay, that our weight fluctuates within a few pounds. You know, the people that weigh themselves multiple times a day, every single day, how do you sort of trust your body will regulate? Part of it for many people is, if you have that one piece of bread, the fear of getting out of control with it and not being able to stop. Like, what is normal eating? How do we trust that some days we're going to overeat? Some days we'll undereat. Some days maybe we'll eat too much, but then our body will kind of regulate and be like, I'm not so hungry now, like being connected to it. How do we eat what we want to eat and not like grilled chicken with salad with dressing on the side?
Our eating disorders really are society telling us we're not good enough.
Exactly. Exactly. And also being able to speak up. My website is called Don't Trust the Mirror. And I came up with that because I spent so much time in front of mirrors. You go out of your house and you're like, oh, I look really good. And then you like pass a reflection somewhere. And you're like, oh my God, look at my stomach. Like, look at my chin. Like, what was I thinking? What it is you're just projecting your feelings onto the mirror. The mirror doesn't change. The mirror is the mirror. But it's like you can't trust it because it's really based on what you're projecting onto it. And I say you can trust the mirror when your insides match your outsides. Like if you are really feeling good about yourself, that mirror will reflect that.
I like that you have that alternative because I want to trust the mirror that it's a reflection of my beauty, no matter what I think I look like. I have a beautiful heart, therefore I'm beautiful. I have a friend who had bulimia, and she said that physically she is not well because of it. Is that anything you've experienced? I mean, is there any long-term effects that you've had?
Well, I will share with you my teeth. At one point when I was recovered, and that's a whole nother topic of like recovery, what is recovery? But I want whiter teeth. Mm-hmm. So I went to my dentist and he said, you're not going to get whiter teeth because my teeth were translucent and you could see all these fractures in them. I had no enamel on my teeth anymore. So that was one long-term effect, my teeth, but also about, and 7 or 8 years ago, I developed terrible intestinal issues. I had an intestinal blockage and had multiple surgeries and have a lot of like bowel issues. And people would be like, do you have diverticulitis? Do you have this? Do you have that? I was like, no, it's not about the food. It's not about, I will never know if it was because of my eating disorder, but I also wonder with all the damage I did to my body, yet part of it is some of the damage that I've done. For so many years, I didn't share with people about my eating disorder. And as a therapist in sort of the analytic police, it was like, you're not really supposed to disclose. But I really felt like it was important for me to talk about it, to be honest about it, because it's so painful to keep secrets. And I felt like I just wanted people to know that they weren't alone, and also to help them provide strategies and ideas to help them. I still journal today. Whatever way you want to express yourself and find your voice, I think is so important. I also find nature helps us heal, and to know that there's help. It's a journey, but you can have a life that's free of all the imprisonment that we put ourselves in. Try to find the beauty within yourself, which can be really hard, and to appreciate the gifts that each individual has going forward.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of Beneath Your Beautiful, hosted by Hara Allison. And thank you for your ratings and reviews. We'll be back next week with a new episode. Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to Don't Trust the Mirror, My Secret Life with an Eating Disorder, with psychoanalyst Maureen Kritzer-Lang, the queen of self-esteem. We hope you enjoyed it. Please visit donttrustthemirror.com, where you'll find all our social networking links and can post your stories, comments, and questions. Until next time, remember, trust yourself. Don't trust the mirror.